You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here for Columbia Calling, episode 334. I'm here in Mompox, Bolivar, so a long way away from everywhere, and that's where we'll be seeing out quarantine here. It's been a good decision to get out of Bogota and allow my children to be in a little more fresh air than an apartment in the big city. Of course, the lockdown continues. Here, we're under total quarantine and curfew during the Virgen de Carmen celebrations, which are raucously celebrated in this region. So therefore, there is a toque de queda, as it's known. You're not allowed out and you're not allowed to party. So we'll see how that has been obeyed and how it will be obeyed in coming days. But anyway, this week's episode is, as I said, episode 334, and we're talking to academic Shauna Galuli, who's on the line from Bogota, and she does a study, and she's doing her PhD, and hosted by the University of California, Irvine, but she's doing her PhD dissertation on a transitional justice and basically the Pacific Coast and some of the problems and issues affecting places like Tumaco, Buenaventura, Cali and Popayan, also to include those regions as well. It's an investigation that has been exhaustive. And I hasten to add, it's a fascinating conversation with Shauna, and she really opens up her knowledge and her expertise in the field, and that she shares this with us is very special indeed. But however, a forewarning, this is Colombia's Pacific Coast. Things out there are far removed from anywhere else in Colombia. And therefore, we will be talking about some of the more tragic elements of issues in Colombian society. There will be talk of narco-trafficking. There will be talk of disappearances, danger, social leaders being killed, the corruption, and the willingness of the Colombian state to overlook a region as rich as the Pacific region in Colombia, and what the resilience of the people there trying to make a living and trying to live their lives from day to day. So there's a little forewarning for you there here in this opening segment about the reality of Colombia's Pacific Coast. But I know that you'll find it informative and interesting because Shauna talks so well about it. And of course, this is her passion. Right now, I'll leave you in the hands of Emily Hart, who'll be doing the new segment this week. And then we'll be back in segment three with Shauna Galuli. So stay listening and thank you again. This is Columbia Calling, episode 334.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of July 20th, 2020. Columbia has now reached 200,000 recorded cases of COVID-19, with 6,500 deaths. This week's new cases were largely concentrated in Bogota, Atlántico, and Antioquia. Against the advice of Colombia's medical community and economists, President Duque has tried to reactivate the economy over the last 2 months, but cities are now again reimposing lockdowns. Intensive care units are already over 80% capacity in Bogota, Cali, and Medellin, though the peak is predicted to arrive in mid-August. Concerns have arisen around the emergency injection of funds promised by the president, intended to help the country confront the pandemic and ensuing economic crisis. Of the promised $1.5 billion investment, the finance ministry transferred less than $110 million to the health ministry and National Health Institute. More than $414 are not accounted for, having been transferred to a trust fund called Fidu Previsora, which has not made its financial records public. Armed groups across Colombia have been imposing their own curfews, lockdowns, and other measures, purportedly to prevent the spread of the virus. Groups have threatened, attacked, and killed those they see as failing to comply. This week, Human Rights Watch revealed the scale of the issue in a new report. In at least 11 of Colombia's 32 states, armed groups have imposed COVID-19 measures. A broad range of groups are involved, from the ELN and FARC dissident groups to paramilitaries. These measures have further undermined people's ability to secure adequate food and sustenance, while targeting and murder of social leaders has continued amid the violence. Colombia's defence minister has announced that the government is ready to resume the aerial fumigation of coca plants, a controversial strategy which was banned in 2015 due to its risks to human health and ecology. And former President Álvaro Uribe has won the latest round in his legal case against Daniel Mendoza, the creator of Matarife, the documentary series which explores Uribe's complicity in war crimes, massacres, drug trafficking and corruption. Last week, the defamation case was thrown out by a judge as inadmissible. This week on appeal, the case has been granted leave to proceed. Mendoza has already been in hiding for some months due to death threats relating to the series. That was the week's news bulletin. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, segment 3 of episode 334 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I am here in Mombos, Bolivar, 5.5 hours in from Cartagena, 5 hours in from Santa Marta, and et cetera, et cetera, and it's hot. And my very special guest this week is Shauna Galuli, and she's in Bogota, where it's not so hot. Anyway, Shauna is an academic. She's been researching a very interesting subject in Colombia for a few years now, and I think she'll tell us why it's taken a few years, but she's doing her PhD at the UC, so that's University of California at Irvine, and she's originally from South Florida, so she's swapped out one coast for the other, but now she's way up in the mountains of Bogota. So welcome on Columbia Calling, Shauna.
Thanks for having me, Richard. This is really exciting. It's my first podcast. So thanks for having me. This is very exciting.
Well, of course, and of course, it should be exciting, and we should be praising one another for our efforts during this extraordinary, challenging time. And just tell me a little bit of something. I was like, all of your work, your investigations are about the Pacific Coast, and if I understand. Properly and appropriately, it's really about government failure to be able to, enact any policy effectively on the Pacific coast. It's in a nutshell, if I were to try and summarize, 4 years of investigations.
Yeah, I mean, that's, can I steal that from my
go
elevator
for it.
Pitch? Yeah, so I mean, I started this project kind of right on the tail end of the failure of the plebiscite in 2016. And in kind of like a larger idea, it's about, well, why does peace and justice, why do processes of peace building and transitional justice, not go so well? Huh. Because, especially when you look back at the history of Colombia, you see similar patterns of violence that emerge over and over and over again, right? What's happening with the assassinations of social leaders and FARC members, you can look back to the UP. You could maybe even draw some comparisons between the liberal and conservative times back in the 1940s and 1950s. So what started as a project about peace building and transitional justice, which it still very much so is a project about that, but it's also about the ways in which if these root causes, these root structures aren't addressed, we'll just continue to see one of the phrases I use is new iterations of violence reemerging over and over again. And they won't be the same, but they'll continue to have similar types of patterns. And that's going to continue to happen until these root structural causes are addressed, which nobody's done. I mean, nobody's addressed them. So
yeah, we talk about them, and I think they probably exist on paper, but... Colombia is fantastically the country of the reforma and contra reforma. So, I mean, we always talk about it, and we do hear these, you know, political dialogues saying, oh, the Pacific Coast, it's been left out. And we're not just talking, I think, in your investigations just about the, let's say, the littoral, the Pacific Coast, Buenaventura, Tumaco, but I think also into Cali is the main economic hub of this area, Popayan, I believe, too, as the departmental capital in that region. It's, but it's, as you say, I would call it totally cyclical, or not even cyclical, it's just a continuation. Could tell us a little bit about these, and then these structural issues. You're the expert. What are we looking at that is really continuing to affect the people and the area?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so when I was in Buenaventura back in February, I actually went to the Banco Republica, which are kind of like these little archives. They do have one in Buenaventura. Huh. And it's really cool because there's texts at the one in Buenaventura that I couldn't find anywhere else, not even at the one in Cali. I tried, primarily by Black intellectuals who have been talking about kind of like the plight of the Pacific since like the 1920s, 1930s. Sophonius Jacob is one of them in particular that I spent some time looking through his stuff. And, you know, he talks about like Tumaco as the jewel of the Pacific and Buenaventura as, you know, another one in the crown of jewels on Colombia's coast. And he's writing these things as the port of Buenaventura is being constructed without permission from local communities. So Ley 70, which gives indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities kind of unprecedented levels of legal autonomy over their traditional territories, is actively flouted in Buenaventura, particularly in terms of the port. The port is a private port, and the people of Buenaventura do not see benefits from the billions of dollars that move through that port every year. 60% of Colombia's total trade moves through that port, and yet people in Buenaventura, most of them live in abject poverty. Most of them don't have running water. I think over a third of the city is issues with these neo-paramilitary groups that are involved with small-scale narco trafficking. So there's a lot of invisible borders within the city itself because of all of these different groups and the way they've carved out the urban center, as well as the rural area for coca production and transport into the city, into the port.
And you, I mean, you see this. I know Tumaco, the coca production, is very close. I mean, to Tumaco itself. And we had those, you know, the headlines. I guess it was last year or the year before, the coca workers and the confrontation. I guess it was coca eradication and coca growers that was taking place there. But is it the same situation in Buenaventura?
So I think it's a little bit different because, I mean, there definitely is still production around Buenaventura, but like a lot of places in Colombia, you know, it's hard to get here from there. Right. Even like the ride from like the city center of Buenaventura, like where the port is to like the quote unquote airport in Buenaventura is, you know, it's like probably about an hour. You know, like the like real road disappears very quickly. It's like a relatively well-maintained road because it leads to the airport. But like, you know, it's kind of one of those things like you can't get there from here. But the coca manages to get there just fine. So I think the issue of logistics is a little bit different in Buenaventura because it's not as close to the center. And also there's a lot of product coming from different parts of the city, right? So we have coca. A lot of it moves through Buenaventura anyways. So you have that moving through, which, you know, that takes from Cali, it's a 3-hour bus ride to Buenaventura.
And when we look at the illegal mining, you can almost see it from that highway. I mean, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and so here's the other thing. It's one of those things that it's like, well, nobody really cares. And that, I mean, at least on the higher up governmental level, nobody really cares, right? Like the bus ride from Cali to Buenaventura is actually really beautiful. And the road is very nice because all of the product that moves in and out of Buenaventura oftentimes comes through Cali. So you need a reliable form of transportation from Buenaventura to Cali. The road is great until you get into the outer city limits of Buenaventura. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of all turns to shit, road-wise.
But it's road-wise. It's not a state of mind. But, like you say, and I thought it was really interesting that you found, and if we go back to the academics from the 1920s, 1930s, you found these documents, you found these writings. I guess they were full of hope and mm-hmm. full of future prospects, and that the Afro communities on the Pacific coast, of course, descended directly from slaves who moved west, from coming in, and who I would say are perhaps more, related to Africa than maybe people now in the Caribbean coast. There's less mm-hmm. of, as you'd say in French, métissage, or the with other immigrants. You say that people don't care, and I believe this. When you say the politicians at the top, they just don't care. Why? I mean, that's a huge question, but I would like to say, and of course you can, I think, because we've got you on camera, you can just nod or shake your head so we don't have you. I think that a lot of people are getting incredibly rich and incredibly wealthy off this willingness to ignore or overlook, let's say, the basic human rights that people should be enjoying.
I think as long as the product, legal and illegal, continues to move through successfully and people continue to make their money, they don't really care mm-hmm. about the impact that has on the community surrounding it. Like the port, so Buenaventura actually has a very proud tradition also of traditional artisanal mm-hmm. fishermen. Mm-hmm. The port and the pollution that's come with the port, with these humongous ships moving through multiple times a day, have ruined that. Mm-hmm. The fish have left because of the disturbance surrounding Buenaventura because of these huge ships, because of the pollution. So, it's getting harder and harder for artisanal fishermen to make a living. And, I talked to some of them last time I was there. These men are in their 50s and 60s. This is what they've been doing for their entire lives. And they, they can really see a difference in the way that, I mean, climate change, as well as like the changes in this microclimate of Buenaventura, like the ships, the pollution, mm-hmm. and the impact that has on the ecosystem. Again, these are men that have been doing this for like 40 years. So they're like, yeah, I mean, it's almost impossible to make a living off of this anymore. And I think in 5 to 10 years, this tradition of artisanal fishery will no longer exist here, which is a shame because it's been around since, before Sophonius wrote about it. Like mm-hmm. it's been around in Buenaventura for forever. And now that it's rapidly disappearing. I think that as long as people continue to make their money off of it, legal or illegal, they don't really care mm-hmm. what happens to the people of Buenaventura, to the people of Cali, to the people of Tumaco.
Your investigations go so deep into this. How do you get up each day?
I kind of figured out the way that I work okay. And it's, I mean, it's not just about me. It's also about protecting the people that I work with, mm-hmm. right? As we both know, you know, community leaders, social movement leaders, basically anybody who is opposed to like who could be perceived as opposed to narco trafficking in any way, shape or form, is under threat in Colombia. And you know, that particularly holds for areas like Tumaco and Buenaventura, like to the max. So I figured out that multiple short trips works best, for me mentally, right. Because I will, you know, I will leave and I will like kind of just spend a week on my couch, like, just like as like just I don't know, to process so much of the terribleness that is happening, that, you know, that absolutely takes like mental effort and it's a mental strain, I guess, but also to protect the people that I collaborate with, the people who have been like so open and welcoming and generous with me. Mm-hmm. You know, in places like Buenaventura and Tumaco, you can see me coming from a mile away. It is very clear that I am not from there.
No.
But the nice thing is,
I'll talk about this, and my longtime listeners will know that I continually wax lyrical about the region. It was the first region I knew in Colombia, and back in the day when I first came over and for WWF and traveled from Guapi down to Buenaventura via Malaga down to Buenaventura in 1998,
99. Oh my God.
In a canoe.
That's insane.
It was insane. And, you know, we did it. We were studying the mangrove swamps and I was writing about it and writing about the communities and so on. And every place we stopped in had actually been pre-organized by the NGO. And we had to check in with the priest in each town, and the priest would then tell the muchachos, and the muchachos would give us permission. And I remember staying in the priest's house with my photographer, and I don't recall the name of the village because it's just one of these villages, you know, on a tributary of a river in an area blessed with many rivers and mangroves. And if you don't know your way around, you don't know your way around. And there was gunfight that night, you know, and I remember saying to the priest, so what was that about? You know, and I was smiling, you know, I pretty much felt safe despite the gunfire and stuff. And he was like, oh, that was alegría. That was just pura alegría. And I was like, that was joy. That was joyfulness. And the guy said, yeah, the guy won some money on the lottery. So he was firing off his guns. And I was like, yeah, but that was guns coming back and forth. That wasn't guns. Someone, you know, that I know when someone's firing their gun in the air and when it's worrying to me as
so
well.
So either the priest was lying to you.
I think the priest was lying to me. I think, you know, again, as you mentioned just previously, they can see you a mile off. They can see me perhaps even further off because I'm slightly taller. and my photographer. Yeah, and my photographer was even whiter than me and with gray hair. So you could just imagine what we stood out in a tributary of these mangrove swamps. But I mean, we talked about this and the fact that you need to digest all of this information and I guess take a step back when you come back to Bogota and lie on your sofa and so on. And I remember this, and it's been a long time since I've been out to the Pacific Coast because I love it, and I love the people, and I love going there, and just this exuberance of nature, and there is a joie de vivre despite everything, you know, the people, but you then, when you scratch that surface, and within minutes, people are talking about the corruption, the lack of healthcare, the lack of good communication, and it's another world. And I just thought, maybe for my listeners, because I would say the majority, and I forgive me for those of you out there who have been to the Pacific Coast and Buenaventura and Tumaco and places. And a lot of us, of course, will have been to Cali and Popayan just because they're just more connected. But if you're going out to the shoreline, aside from artisanal fishing in Buenaventura or working in the port, what do people work? What is the employment?
So there's not much. Yeah. I mean, particularly in Buenaventura, that's why like a third of the residents are unemployed, because you have the port, artisanal fishery, which is rapidly disappearing. There's a few, when I say few, I literally mean three, like okay-ish hotels that people actually stay in, right? And it's immediately near the port. One of them is like Cosmos Pacifico or something like that. Yeah, that's like the really fancy one for like the multinational executives who come to Buenaventura for a hot second to check out the port and then leave. And then other than that, there's, I don't know, like participating in some chain of narco trafficking.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really the only option that a lot of people, particularly young people in the city, have. And like so many demands from communities have been demands for other opportunities, demands for educational opportunities, demands for things like art and music laboratories, because there is such potential and talent in these areas. Colombia's best soccer players come from where?
Pacific.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where these demands are. I mean, if you're driving out of Buenaventura, you see like the abandoned like University of the Pacific site, that there is not anything there anymore. There really has been so much kind of almost actively done to prevent people from having other opportunities. And like we touched on, as long as people continue to get their money, they don't really care. And I think what really demonstrates this was the success of the paro of Buenaventura in 2017. So back in 2017, there was a national strike in Buenaventura where they basically blockaded the port and said, things need to be fixed in Buenaventura. And until the national government comes down here and negotiates and gives us something, nothing comes in or out of the port.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there were clashes, people were hurt, people were killed. But the government capitulated in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The government came down, negotiated with the leaders of the movement and agreed to terms, including extra development funds for Buenaventura. I think the less successful Paro Nacional could learn something from the success of, you know, Buenaventura's Paro back in 2017. But that just goes to show, as long as the goods keep coming in and out of the port, like nobody really cares.
Yeah. Now, I remember this. I have to interject that. I remember this paro, and I remember, you know, looking at it, and I know that the people have every right to do so, to stake a claim in needing and getting better service. That was 2017. We're in 2020. Has anything truly happened? Well, that would be, you know, we were looking first at the Santos government and then the Duque government. Have the promises come through, or is it just much of the same?
So I think partially yes and partially no. So there was an amount that was promised to Buenaventura in those negotiations, like immediately.
Yeah.
And I think back in like March 2019, there was a meeting about if the government had how much of those terms that the government had complied with. The Comité Nacional, Comité Paro de Buenaventura said that the government has complied with about 30%. The national government says they've complied with about 60%. I personally believe the Comité Paro de Buenaventura more than I believe the national government on that one. So the other thing was a 10-year development plan for Buenaventura. And
we don't think there's
because
any
again, move. I mean, if you go, I mean, I think that there's some, but not, you know, not a ton.
No.
Because if you're in Buenaventura and apart from the port area, there's maybe about like 4 or 5 blocks surrounding the port right on the water that are like quote unquote okay. To just like walk around, to like be in. And it's really interesting because, like, for example, again, when I was leaving, early in the morning for one of my flights back to Bogota from Buenaventura, there were cops guarding the hotel. So like, to me, you know, amongst the other things I've seen during my time there is the government from a security standpoint has made it very clear what they're most interested in protecting. And in the case of Buenaventura, that is almost exclusively private property, between the port, which is private property, as well as these like fancy-ish hotels, right, that are the ones where most of the foreigners either come to inspect the port or spend a night in before they go off to like the cute little eco hostels on the coast that you have to leave from Buenaventura from. And so, it's kind of like a very obvious that the government decides that they want to protect private property in Buenaventura over anything else. I mean, there's whole neighborhoods there that the government can't enter because it's just completely controlled by kind of these narco paramilitary groups. I guess illegal armed actors is the most general way to put it. They're definitely involved in narco trafficking, and the government, just like the police and military, just don't go into those neighborhoods. They just can't.
You talk about, I have to quickly say, you know, but there was a couple of things there as the actively sort of ignoring Buenaventura. And then you said the 5 blocks, which you said, quote unquote, okay. I mean, I would press, you know it far better than I do. And as I, last time I was there, I can't even think, it might have been 2008 or 2007, so it's a few years since. For me, it was like 1 block, 1.5 blocks. And I tried to go down and take some pictures of the port, and there was actually a drug deal, small drug deal going on at the end of the port, which I hadn't realized until a couple of guys with guns came running at me with my camera, and I ended up showing them that I erased the photos and so on. So then I went back to my hotel and with my telephoto lens was able to take the photos from my balcony. Unfortunately, I've since lost those photos somewhere, but I remember because this was a way back when I just did, it was a promise as well. I just did travel stuff and it wasn't going to get too involved and so on. It was, again, it was slightly different back then. And I said, well, you know, I'll get a guide. Show me around, show me the points. There was no guide. So, okay. Okay. I'll get a taxi. Say, show me some interesting points. We drove around the block. I mean, we just drove around the block. All he did was he wanted, you know, the fare. Then I said, so what's there to do? I got taken to what was could only have been described as a Chinese gentleman's brothel. And so since I've talked to my friend who's a Lonely Planet author, his name's Alex Edgerton, and he always does the Pacific Coast and stuff. And I said, well, what did you do most recently when you wrote up the Lonely Planet area? He goes, well, yeah, I went up to the viewpoint.
And I said, well, don't take me up to the viewpoint. And the guy was like, well, why not? And he said, well, they killed three people up here last week. You know, it's like, I mean, you know, we're laughing, but it's tragic.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things that like, so it's also a very different experience, like going to field sites by yourself versus with other people. So I was in Tumaco right before quarantine started, and I was there with a group, and that was a very different experience. Mm-hmm. I was there with a few people from CNAP, and that was a very different experience from being in Buenaventura by myself. I did not leave my hotel after dark, period. Fortunately, the food in Buenaventura is great. That's what I will say.
Yeah.
The food is incredible. But yeah, I mean, I didn't leave after dark, period. Yeah. And I mean, I think even with the group,
Yeah.
I mean, so the area immediately around the port, and kind of right in front of the water side, they've kind of converted it into like this little park situation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool. There's like an open air stage and like a playground and like space for, like there's like a soccer court thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of like little restaurant type situations. So I think that actually has been in part a result of some of the negotiations that happened back in 2017, although I'm not totally sure. So that immediate area is okay. And there's a couple of blocks, like the port, the hotels. I walked to Banco de la República, which is about a whole block away from my apartment. So I think that's, we're at about 4 blocks total. But I think there are other parts of the city that are like, okay, but it's just these issues of invisible borders.
Yeah.
And the way these different groups have carved up the urban space, it's like you can't just walk from point A to point B, even if it's just like 5 minutes away, right? So like I spent some time in Puente Nayero, which is an international humanitarian space organized by leaders back in 2014 to kicked out all of the armed groups and this immediate space. And with the support of the international community, made it an international humanitarian space. It's like 2 blocks. But like within those 2 blocks, like, but to get to Puente Nayero, you have to move through this very uncertain space.
It's an island within this community. Therefore, you know, so wonderful that it's, let's say, a remanso de paz in this area, but also, I mean, you're running a risk to get there and to leave there. I mean, so that's, but I understand. I mean, this is one of those sort of, as they say, you know, island mentality type things, or that social workers will say, well, we've made this, and hopefully the borders then go, you know, expanding out. But given the nature of Buenaventura's geography and the control of territory, it's probably more complex than that.
Yeah. And you know, unfortunately, the opposite thing has happened, right? There's still this space. But, you know, some of the community leaders told me that it's like, well, we very much still feel the pressure from like, just like immediately outside of the space, we feel the pressure of like these armed groups kind of pressing in. You know, one of them told me, like, I know for a fact that, like, if I go downtown, like, it's over for me. Like, they'll get me if I leave this space. So, like, it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's kind of like a fortress.
Yeah.
It's like this small space, and it's what they've got.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, especially now, they're even more starting to feel the pressure of these groups kind of pushing in on the boundaries. And, you know, a part of the reason why this group organized back in 2014 to expel the armed groups, was because of the Casa de Pique that was in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
or
you're going to have to explain to my listeners
to like slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
So to, I guess the best translation for it would be slaughterhouse. So basically what, you know, these armed groups did, as a way to terrorize the community as well as individual person, they would take somebody into one of these wooden shacks. And that's other thing in Buena Ventura, everything is constructed out of wood. You can hear what's going on in other houses. You know, there's empty spaces between the slats. You can hear what's happening. And they would basically torture this person, you know, cut off parts of their body, and torture them. And, you know, the, like the screaming and the chainsaws, you could hear it throughout the community. So it's a form of terror, not only for the person, obviously, but for the entire community. And these still exist in Buena Ventura. Like this still happens in parts of Buena Ventura. Like it's casas de pique are very much so still a thing in different communities throughout the city.
I mean, the most horrendous, the horrendous thing to think about and to consider. And I, you know, for me, at the end of it, when I sort of imagine living within earshot of something of this nature, but I also think, who are the people that can do something like this? Who, you know?
Yeah, I actively go out of my way to avoid as much attention and or interaction with any of these people as possible. You know, it's not where my research is located. And, you know, out of safety for myself, as well as for the people that I work with, it's just like a, well, let me stay as far away from that as possible.
Yeah. But we don't.
I don't know. And I think that, you know, when I sit on my couch for a week, that is one of the things that it's just hardest to wrap your head around. Like how does this exist? Like, how do you do this? How do you do this to somebody else? And somebody that you probably know.
Even if
it's just tangentially, you know, the, you know, Buena Ventura, Tumaco, like they're cities, but they're pretty like small, you know, like people know each other. Even if you know this person, you probably know them tangentially or, you know, their aunt or, you know, their cousin or whatever. And so like, how can you do this to somebody? And then how can you do this to somebody that you like, you know, and that's, there's just like, that's something that's, I don't have a
jump into this a little bit here, but I don't want to talk much more about this this subject because I find it so very hard. But and everyone you work with and everyone you research obviously, you know, is running some kind of risk. That's the truth. You know, social groups, community leaders, they're all running an hour-to-hour, day-to-day risk. That's the truth. And, of course, we understand as academics, we can step back, we can leave, we're foreigners. But have you yourself been subjected or had any threats against your person?
No, I haven't. So I, you know, I've known people who have been threatened. I've known a few people tangentially who have been assassinated over the past couple of years. You know, I think a part of it is like fish too small, which is like totally cool with me. And that's something else to reckon with, like as an academic and something I spend a lot of time thinking about is like, so like, what good is this work doing? Is it putting people in danger? Is this exploitative? And how can I make this an equal transaction through, you know, taking people's time, their experience? how do I do the most to make sure that my presence or their interaction with me does not put them in more danger? Mm. So that, you know, like I definitely like could go on about like the, this idea of like reflexive field work, particularly in conflict zones. And I think that like for a long time, people have done it like really badly.
Yeah.
But fortunately there's kind of like this new-ish school of academics who I think are doing it really well. And I take a lot of my cues from them, like, you know, reading what they've written about, like, how do I do this? In a way that's like respectful and equitable, and like doesn't and doesn't deny the people who are the true experts who have been doing this work for decades. That does like that doesn't deny them their agency. Yeah,
I think
I spent a lot of time thinking about that,
and rightly so. And of course, I'm sure it's a vast chapter in your dissertation at the end, because I've had to do that. Even, you know, my studies are just downtown, and I mean I say just downtown, but it's nowhere nowhere alongside Buenaventura, Tumaco, going into the communities. I can walk in, and then if I get into trouble, jump into a cab and stuff. And but I am very aware that my mere presence creates a change, and the way that two people talk to me is going to be different. And I'm very aware that there are ripple effects from my, let's say, arrival near to the old Bronx and places like that, or the new Bronx. I'm very aware of these things, and so it's you know, it's something to be taken into account. And that kind of leads me into one of my final. I've got two final questions. First of all, because, and you've touched on it, well, by talking about the nature of research and how you perhaps, you know, you've got to think about all of these things, but how is it that you got into this study? How did you pick this study? And hopefully, once it's, you know, the study's out, the dissertation's there, and it's published as a book, because that's going to be, that's all of our plans.
Someday.
What do you hope to do with this?
I think that one of the things, like embracing the idea that to a certain extent, like I am like pretty useless.
Don't say
it,
that.
Like, well, it is, you know, what my collaborators get in return from me is not at all equal in what they're sharing with me. And so I like, in part, I like, without sounding too like, I don't know, too much. It's like in part to bear witness. Not a lot of people, like not a lot of people come, not a lot of people come to listen. And not a lot of people come to listen to these communities. So I think in part it's like to bear witness and to do like what I can to spread awareness about what they're going through, like via, like, especially through like English media outlets or like writing like public engagement articles, which is conversations I've had about, with these different communities. They're like, yes, like we want you to talk about these things. We want people to know, you know, like we want the English speaking world to know like what's going on and what we're going through, because like Colombia barely knows about what these communities are going through, let alone the international community, with of course some exceptions. So they're like, yes, we want like awareness to be spread about these things. You know, I do like small things throughout my interactions with them, as a form of like equitable transaction. Sometimes it's like land accompaniment. That was a Spanglish word there. You know, accompaniment to returns. Land returns for some folks, like organizing like some fundraisers for like specific needs, stuff like that. But I think like the larger thing is like to bear witness and to spread awareness as much as I can. Right. Cause also at the end of the day, like I am a lowly PhD candidate. So, you know, talk to whoever will listen to me about this, which today is you.
Yeah. Well, I'm listening and my listeners are listening. So thank you. So, But and then this has been a conversation which has largely and entirely up until this point, and I will take full responsibility for this, it has been coronavirus free. But we have to ask. We have to ask, because that's the reality, the extraordinary reality that we're living right now. How are these communities, these cities dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak?
Well, so the same issues apply, but magnified, because now we're in the middle of a pandemic. There's much less readily available medical care, PPE. I mean, Jesus, there's barely a hospital. Buenaventura has a clinic. Tumaco has a clinic, not a hospital. Buenaventura has a hospital-ish thing. But not really. So like the same issues apply. There's a lack of medical care that's only been heightened in this. And, you know, in some areas, I'm sure you saw, you know, some of these news articles that are coming out, these armed groups subjecting people to brutal lockdown, because it's like, leave your house or die. Basically, you know, there's some of these areas, that is happening, especially in the more rural areas around Tumaco and stuff. You know, Choco is a bit outside of my field house, but I know that there's active fighting in Quibdó between the ELN and paramilitaries as they're using the opportunity of coronavirus and the lockdown to make gains as urban militias. And so there's civilians actively being harmed in the crossfire there. I want to say it's like 60 people have died from firefighting between the two.
We know nothing about it.
No.
We know nothing about it. It's the truth. That's that willing isolation of the region.
And it's so it's just, it's making everything worse, like 10 times worse. And it will be, I don't know, interesting, difficult to see the way that these places change once we've gotten past coronavirus, because I know for a fact that this moment has created the opportunity for groups to shift the power balance. So, you know, for example, I'm not totally sure when or even if I will physically be able to get back to Buenaventura in the next year or so. Like, I'm not sure, you know, beyond coronavirus concerns, I'm not sure that it will be safe enough for me to get back, because of the way coronavirus has created opportunities for these different armed groups to shift the power balance in their favor. And they don't really care who they hurt in the process of doing that. And it's so unfortunate. You know, 2018, one of my collaborators told me, you know, she was like, the presidential election in 2018 was the first time there was no election violence in Buenaventura in a general, like in living memory, basically. And that was incredible. But there's been this rapid backslide that I'm afraid is just going to be heightened and happen so much quickly because of coronavirus. And it's one of those things that I actually do think that the national government, with a few exceptions, is doing the best that they can in like a horrific situation. But these issues that the Pacific is forgotten, the Pacific is abandoned, continues. And why would that not continue in the middle of coronavirus? So there's not enough medical care. There's not enough medical equipment. There's no medical equipment kind of left for the Pacific.
It's compounding the issues and the problems and the disasters in the area. And you know what? As an overall sort of, as I would say, a summary of what we've been talking about, is there's no quick fix, because we're looking at I mean, you've got your documents, and we kind of circle back to the 1920s and 1930s. So we're looking at, you know, 100 years of abandon, 100 years of corruption and isolation. And I don't want to get into it, but I think there's a large element of racism directed as well. You know, that's for another podcast, I think. And but I'm really, really appreciative of you taking the time to talk to us a little bit. We really haven't discussed anything on this show, I don't think, for months, if not years, about the Pacific Coast. And so I think it's, especially in this time in which we're living, it's very important to continue to inform. You know, we have some upbeat shows and we have some, like this one, not so upbeat shows, but yeah. We're hearing it from someone who knows, which is greatly different. And it's not like, you know, we never approached this as if it was going to be a fluff episode. We never approached this saying, you know, we're going to talk about beautiful beaches and, you know,
which there are.
Which there are. But, so let me just say thank you so much for your time, Shauna Kaluli, for being on this episode 334 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And I know at some point you'll be able to physically get back and visit your contacts, friends and acquaintances there on the Pacific Coast. But until it's totally safe, please don't go, and please stay safe on your sofa in Bogota.
thank you Richard. This was it was fun. I don't know if fun's the right word considering the themes we covered, but it was great talking to you about this. So thanks again for having me.
You're most welcome, and hopefully it's somewhat cathartic to you as well, you know, for you.
It was.
Great stuff. So this is me, Richard McCollum, on Boz Bolívar here, seeing out the quarantine. Seeing out the quarantine here in Colombia that seems to extend forever. We've been talking to Shauna Kaluli, an academic from the University of California at Irvine. She's there in Bogota. Very interesting subject. Bring this podcast, this episode, to a close now, and remind you that we'll be back next week with another great interview here on the Columbia Calling podcast. Lined up, we have Gregorio Uribe, who's a Colombian musician, named as one of Colombia's 100 most influential people overseas. So very cool to get that musician, and he's worked with Rubén Blades and other people. So we'll have him on the show and take the show next week in a little bit of a different direction. But thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been Rich McCall in Montreal. Bye-bye.